Hello and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for today. Our program today is the emerging prehistory of the next American Revolution with Gar Alperovitz, professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative. Just give you a brief bio of Gar to let you get you in the mood and then we'll turn it over to Gar. Gar Alperovitz is a renowned political economist and a leader in the new economy movement. Gar is co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative and Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland, as well as former legislative director for the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate. His latest book is titled What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. Please introduce Gar. Please welcome Gar.
Thank you. And thank you all for coming on such a beautiful day in San Francisco. It's wonderful to be here. The argument of this book, What Then Must We Do?, and of this talk, and of the work we're doing at the Democracy Collaborative, is that we face a systemic crisis, not a political crisis. So let me clarify what I mean by that. I mean that the problem you see in the newspapers about the Republicans blocking and the Tea Party blocking is not the central issue that we're facing. And it is not that you can't move money out of Washington and that you can't get a stimulus program as Paul Krugman would ask for. Those are problems. But the way you can detect a systemic problem, one that is deeply rooted in the very architecture of the political economic system, is if long trends, negative trends, do not shift. Irrespective of the things I just mentioned and irrespective of who gets elected, they are being generated by far deeper things in the political economic system, in its very architecture. And if that is true, and I think it is true, and we'll talk about that, then the question becomes, how do you change the architecture, the fundamental nature of the system that is generating long trends, irrespective of the political moment? Now that's in the 1960s, that was called a heavy rap for some of you older folks. That is, it is a challenging argument. So let me tell you what I mean by that. Over the last 30 years, the top 1% has increased its share of income from about 10% of the economy to about 20% over 30 years. Average income, that means the bottom 99% didn't have that money. They lost it on the long trend. CO2 production has increased 30% since the 1970s. Long trend. Some of the interesting ones, poverty has not increased. It has not decreased. It has increased. Even after we passed an increase in the minimum wage bill 4 years ago, we are lower in real dollar terms than we were in the 1960s. The trends are negative. Average wage of the average worker has not increased more than a few pennies for 30 years, literally. So those are the kinds of trends. I'll give you one other because people don't often focus on it, and it has to do with liberty, the great American value. I test liberty not so much by the complexities of what this court, this conservative court, does or does not do, but how many people lose their liberty. And over the last 30 years, we've gone from 85 per 100,000 in prison to something like 750 per 100,000 in prison, largely black and brown. We are 7 times per capita higher than any other advanced system, including Russia, in the percent of the population we imprison, one way or another, and the trend is long and ongoing. I could go into ecological trends, the decline in corporate taxation from about 6-7% of the GDP to the 1-2% range has gone on. My book articulates and lays out some of these numbers in very quick fashion, but I think you get the idea. Now, if you focus on long trends that don't change with politics, you then have to ask, what is the nature of the system that is producing the trends, and is there any way to change the system? Or you can ignore the trends and not bother. Or you can say, well, too big for me. So my contention and my urge to you is that you consider this as a genuine problem, a problem that many people in history have faced in their own time of history, in their own systemic crisis, and then ask, what is it that we must do, or the title of the book, what then must we do, and how do you proceed? So I wear a hat as a historian and a political economist, and as mentioned, I've run House and Senate staffs and did policy planning in the State Department. I've been in the real world of politics, and my suggestion to you is that there may be a way, with that as background about my own limited experience, there may well be a way to change the system. We'll see, and it's worth a hell of a try, and a lot of people are trying. So that's the second argument of the book. Now, let's get into it. Systems are defined historically, not surprisingly, by who controls the wealth. In feudalism, the people, the lords and the church and the king controlled the land, and they controlled the action politically. In state socialism, the state controlled the wealth with disastrous results for liberty and democracy, but the wealth concentration was in the state. 19th century American capitalism, 19th century, was something like a free market capitalist system. Mainly farmer capitalists. American farmers were always in a market, selling to the world market, selling to the national market. They were not peasant farmers as in many parts of Europe. And then small business capitalism produced something like a liberty vision, Jacksonian era, where there was dispersed power, not quite as dispersed as some think, but the power followed who owned capital, and a lot of it was smallholders before the concentrations occurred. We live in a corporate capitalist system, which means that the dominant share of ownership is in the corporations and those who own them. And we're going to talk a little bit about capitalism and corporate capitalism. It comes in different flavors, but the main characteristic is that the ownership of wealth is extremely concentrated. How concentrated, most people don't quite realize. This is the number that really is an eye-opener if you ponder it, and it's been checked many times. I didn't believe it the first six times I looked at it. The top 400 individuals, not percent, you could easily get them in this room, have more wealth than the bottom 180 million people taken together. That is a medieval concentration of wealth in the systemic design. Let me repeat that. The systemic design you and I live in has concentrated power and wealth to that degree. I should amend that. Last time I spoke, a medieval historian came up to me and said, never that concentrated in medieval times. Probably true. I've looked at some numbers. I'm not a medieval historian, but I've looked at some numbers. It is an extreme concentration of power, and it has impact on all of the trend designs. Now, I worked in the House and Senate in the 60s and 70s. We lived in a slight variant of the corporate capitalist systemic design in those years. And I don't think most people have realized that that era really is over, not only in terms of trends, but in the systemic design, which means, if you like what you saw in the Medicare, Medicaid, environmental programs, feminist gains, et cetera, of the 1960s and 1970s, if the design that allowed or produced that is over, and I will contend it is over, then that poses the question of systemic design and how do you change the system in a very different practical way. So let me just briefly outline that. The particular variant of corporate capitalism we lived with, and particularly from the environmental and income distribution levels, was a design that allowed the corporations to hold and own, and their owners to hold and own the capital, by and large. I'm obviously simplifying. And it was countervailed by institutional power built into the design, not just politics. That's John Kenneth Galbraith's phrase, countervailing power. And at the heart of the design was the institution of the labor union, not only on the shop floor, but politics was powerfully influenced all throughout the advanced industrial world, in Europe as well, and it's called social democracy there, and here we call it liberalism. I come out of liberalism. The systemic design included labor unions as part of the muscle that gave power to countervail, regulate, tax, or incentivize the corporation. That was the way it worked. And it worked reasonably well in the 1960s and 1970s. And for those of you who are environmentalists, we passed the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Environmental Protection Agency was established in those years, but so was Medicare, Medicaid, the anti-poverty programs, an increase in the minimum wage, et cetera, in that era. That era and that design of the system is over by virtue of the total collapse and disintegration of labor as an organized institutional power base to manage the power of the corporation. So a couple numbers. American labor unions were never powerful by European standards. The Swedish labor unions had 85% of the labor force in unions. At our peak in the 1950s, we were at about 34.5% membership of the unions. That was the countervailing base. It has gone down steadily for the last 30 years. We are now at roughly 11% of the membership of workers are in unions, 6.6 in the private sector, and decaying, declining. So let that sit for a moment. Look at it. The whole structural power of that system that countervailed and counterbalanced when I worked in the House and Senate, and when many of you were working and doing politics, is gone. Hard, tough reality to face, and very few, if any, believe the labor movement will rebuild powerfully again. Some states, maybe California, for complex reasons, including ethnic origin of a big increasing section of the demography, may have a more powerful union base, but globally throughout the United States, that is not happening. What's happening now is the loss of labor. Now you have the dilemma. If the great trends that are decaying for the last 30 years are the result of a system which has lost its countervailing base and is not likely to get it back, either there is another way to build a positive direction institutionally, or those trends continue. So that's the argument of the book. And the second challenge to the conventional wisdom that certainly I was brought up with, and many in this room, I suspect, were and may still accept. So I am for politics, progressive politics, whatever can be done to alter or modify the difficult pain that people are feeling. Don't misunderstand. We'll take whatever we can get in the way of the old politics. But at the same time, if we want to alter the trends, something's got to change. System designs, as I mentioned, usually come in terms of who owns the wealth and capital. So if you can't put it in the corporations, if the small business variant is over because the big fish eat the little fish and we get concentrated corporate power, that's the pattern. If we can't countervail, if you don't want to put it in the state, for the reasons I argued, what do you want? The system design problem is on the table. Now, we usually talk about it in kind of abstract, radical terms. Mrs. Thatcher famously said, TINA, T-I-N-A, there is no alternative. Or we say, you know, sit, you can't do it, the only option is communism. And the argument of this book is that that is a fallacious argument, that is foolish, that we have allowed ourselves to imbibe the notion that there is only one other alternative. So then the question is, if that's true, if you don't like corporate capitalism, I am talking to the person in your chair. If you don't like corporate capitalism and you don't like state socialism, what do you want? It's a genuine intellectual and political problem. And if you don't have an answer, and if you accepted the argument I just offered in its sketch, hopefully the book will provide more detail, that really is the first question. Is there an alternative? And secondly, how do you get from here to there, given what I said? Well, I want to suggest to you that there could be an alternative, that there is a direction for an alternative, though not fully specified as yet, and that we have the responsibility and the opportunity to begin to design and clarify what we mean. And secondly, that there might be a path forward. That, again, is one of those heavy rap questions. It's very difficult and challenging to say not only that there might be another system, that we might be able to define it, and that there might be a way to get there from here to there, maybe. So if the argument continues that the ownership of wealth is the critical necessary but not sufficient condition of any change in systemic power, must be a change in the ownership of wealth. And if you don't want to put it in the state, and you don't want to put it in the corporation, obviously there must be some decentralized, democratic form of ownership of wealth that provides a different alternative so that there is a democratic base for a new systemic direction that might ultimately countervail and ultimately perhaps overcome. Simple argument. You've got to put it, capital has to be located someplace in the system. And it turns out that if you look carefully at what is not being reported by the press, and we do a lot of research on this, and those of you who follow trends in the press know that the American newspapers and television are extremely stressed, losing reporters, losing the capacity to report, often dominated by conservative owners, and unable and unwilling, but mostly unable, to actually report what's going on the ground. You can't find it in the papers or on television. So some of the things I'm going to describe to you that are going on that have the characteristic of changing who owns wealth in a democratic way that is decentralized and ecologically sustainable by design, that is expanding in many parts of the country, you won't find there. I'll give you a website. You'll find it in this book, but I'll give you a website now that will give you more and more leads to this. It's called community-wealth. Put the dash in. There's one without the dash. And what it is a compendium of information and other websites that follow this trend more closely than you can get it in a short talk or even in my book. So let me give you some examples. Both out of history in the United States and emerging rapidly in new forms is the most obvious way to decentralize and democratize the ownership of wealth, and that is the common garden variety cooperative. That is a one-person, one-vote, decentralized ownership structure. It's obviously not the only one. We're going to talk about bigger ones. But it is very down-home, very conventional, very American. And there are 130 million Americans who are already members of cooperatives, including the credit unions, the rural cooperatives, the agricultural cooperatives, new cooperatives, food co-ops. You name it, they're happening all over the country, and they are expanding. That's 40% of the population has that experience. The most important part of that is the credit union. Obvious credit unions in the United States have put them together, and they have more capital than any of the big five banks. They're a big deal. They have kind of disintegrated in terms of their politics. They are very conventional, mostly very boring, but they have the potential of fueling and giving power to investment for a different direction. And some people are beginning to be aware of that. So, for instance, in some parts of the country, a light bulb has gone on that this one person, one vote bank, all over the country, very conventional, the board is elected by the members. And nobody ever goes to the membership meetings. Nothing there. Boring institution. You can elect the board of the credit union, people realize, if you have a different direction. And in some parts of the country, there is an interest in using that to help fuel what's called the new economy movement. But there it is, sitting there out of American tradition and moving slowly in a new direction. Co-ops, worker co-ops in particular, are another area of modern expansion. Some of you have seen information on this, and I'm going to tell you about some in Cleveland. They're very exciting. Information on the new Era Windows program in Chicago, which was a takeover by workers and setting up a worker co-op. Everywhere I go lecturing about this, somebody comes up to me with three new examples of worker-owned co-ops that the press isn't covering. Another illustration of the possibility. Here's another one. Public banking. Public banks is kind of, what is that? I suppose most people here do or do not know that the state of North Dakota, very conservative state, has a socialist bank as part of its structure. The Public Bank of North Dakota is owned by the state, makes money for the taxpayers, has been there for 90 years, has the support of small business and farmers, and is a model that is being taken seriously by activists all over the country. 20 states have had legislation introduced to set up state banks, and some of them are quite advanced, and particularly in Oregon and Washington State. Another form of democratizing ownership in the finance area. There are 10,000 worker-owned companies other than worker co-ops. There are 3 million more people in worker-owned companies in the United States than are members of unions in the private sector. Most people don't know that, and they are all over the place, large scale, small scale, some reaching to 100,000 people, Publix supermarkets in the South, if you know, 150,000 members, worker-owned companies. They're very conventional. And importantly, there are tax credits, excuse me, there are tax credits now available for people who sell their firms, entrepreneurs, to the workers. It's very tax advantageous to do it, and the baby boom is retiring. There will be millions of people selling their companies, and the choice they face, I'm just doing a piece for the New York Times on this now, the choice they face is either to sell to their workers and get a tax benefit, or to sell to a large corporation and watch the fruit of their life's work probably be disintegrated and gobbled up and integrated in the large corporation. But big changes are possible in that area in the direction of another element of decentralized democratic ownership. I'll give you another one. The book is filled with this, and I'm just reporting the news that the newspapers can't report. And it is an expanding trend. Land trusts. A land trust is another form of democratic ownership of capital. You draw a circle around a big piece of land, set up a nonprofit corporation or a city-owned corporation. It is virtually the only way to control gentrification, by socializing the land in that way and capturing the land values and preventing gentrification. Let me give you an idea about the trend. 30 years ago, there were 2 land trusts in the United States. It was regarded as a radical, foolish, impractical idea. They are all over the country now. In Irvine, California, the city is doing 5,000 units of housing in a land trust. Just to be provocative, in a socialized land scheme. That's what it is. It's a public ownership of the land rather than to give it to the developers and try to tax back the gains. Another aspect of this that you probably don't read in the press. In most cities, when you establish a mass transit system, at the exits, there will be a radical increase in land values. Why? It's a good place to locate stores and housing. The traditional method was let the developers take it and then try to tax back some of those gains created by the public investment. Not anymore. In many, many cities, the cities now own that land and lease it, capturing the profit increase from the public investment for public purpose. Again, changing the ownership structure in this case. I'm obviously giving you a lot of these. There are 2,000 public utilities in which the city produced 25% of American electricity. 25% is inherently already changed in ownership, either co-op production or city utilities. I could go on. And there are many, many, many movements of this kind, 5,000 community development corporations, growing social enterprise, B corporations. We can talk about all of that. The important point, first, is to note there's something out there, very American, changes who owns things, often ecologically very sophisticated, as well as changing ownership, and building up knowledge and experience about how actually in practice one might really begin to understand how to democratize the ownership of wealth in a very down-home, very American fashion. Now, I'm a historian, as I mentioned, and a political economist. I am not naive about politics. I know how difficult it is. Why is this happening? The argument of this book is that it is not an accident that we're seeing this development, which might become the basis of a larger possibility. Remember, those of you who know about the New Deal, virtually every New Deal program was developed in the local state and local, quote, laboratories of democracy at smaller scale. And when the moment was right, the principles that had been refined at the local and state level became the basis of principles for national level policies. The argument of this book is that we are in the prehistory, not the history, the pre-build-up time of a potential great transformation. So if you look at these models in terms of what they are, you see one thing. If you look at in terms of where they may go and why they are expanding, you see a possible another thing. They are expanding primarily because of the systemic crisis, in my view. People do not have opportunities in many parts of the country to achieve public gains and social gains the old way, under the old system design, out of progressive politics that I came out of and used to run in the House and Senate. It isn't doing things. Take a city like Cleveland, and we'll come back to this. The jobs, you give tax incentive to the large corporation to come in and bring in jobs. They come in for a while. They leave. The money goes away, and the jobs disintegrate, and the city goes down. 800,000 city, now 400,000. Detroit's lost 1 million people. But the old way doesn't work, and the pain continues at the local level. Try to set up small business in that environment. It's very difficult, impossible. Money goes in, and the firms collapse. Or if they work, they run to the suburbs, leaving the decay behind. If you try to regulate the same phenomena, you can't manage the power relationships. The corporations play different states off against each other. If you train people at the local level for new jobs, there aren't any jobs. I haven't even mentioned the problems of stagnation and the decaying economy that are coming out of the systemic crisis. We will get to that shortly, in brief, obviously, today. So think about this. The emerging context does not allow the old way. The pain levels increase, and people are up against either they do something new or the pain continues. That is a historic crisis. It is a systemic crisis at the very core of the design of the system, and we are beginning to see very interesting responses largely out of the crisis, not only because people are idealists, and not only because they're activists, but because once you look at it, there aren't other things to do that will do anything. So all the things I've sketched, and there are myriad more that are covered in the book or at that website, are developing for certain reasons. So let me give you, they're not only developing in numbers, they are developing in several other ways. They are generating the notion in very practical, very down-home American terms that there may be a way to build the basis of transforming wealth ownership in an American form that is very peculiarly ours and very practical. Let me give you an example, because they are also growing in sophistication. And I worked with the Youngstown Steelworkers in 1977. Youngstown was the first big major steel closing in the United States. 5,000 people lost their jobs at once. That was front page news in 1977. It no longer is, because it happens so often now. Steelworkers in that area and the community religious leaders said, why don't we set up a worker-owned mill? Why can't we do that? What's wrong with that idea? Just very practical. And they did their politics. They got the Carter administration to give them enough money to do an extremely sophisticated plan. I oversaw the plan of the nation's steelworkers and the best experts in the country. It was a viable plan. And then the Carter administration pledged $200 million in loan guarantees to put the plan on the map, worker community ownership of a large scale, not small scale. And after the election of 1978, the money disappeared. Not surprisingly, people understood the politics of this was difficult, but they had done their political work and they were building a base around the country, and particularly in Ohio. Long story short, and what the ball to watch in this story is time development over time in changing ideas, numbers, sophistication, institutional shifts over time, prehistory of the New Deal, possible prehistory of the next system. Over time, the state of Ohio now has more worker-owned companies, perhaps, than any, we don't know exactly because the numbers aren't very good, but perhaps than any other state in the country, all over the state. And sophistication has increased. In the city of Cleveland, if you go to one of the neighborhoods, there are 40,000, 40% unemployment, black, $18,000 family income, poor neighborhood. Right in the middle of that neighborhood are very sophisticated worker-owned companies built up on the tradition that came out of the Youngstown fight 30 years ago. One professor set up a center at Kent State University to aid this. The ideas around sophistication has developed. And there are large, not small, sophisticated developments. So, for instance, the largest urban greenhouse in the United States, hydroponic, is now a worker-owned company as part of a complex in Cleveland. 3 million heads of lettuce a year. I just learned to do that, you've got to plant 26,000 seeds every single day. Big deal. Also, one of the most advanced industrial-scale laundries servicing hospitals in the area, worker-owned. A large solar installation company, worker-owned, online to put in double the capacity that now exists in the state of Ohio. And moreover, watch the sophistication coming out of this experimentation. They are linked together with a nonprofit corporation so that part of the profits build the community, not just a few workers. And some of the money goes into a revolving fund to set up new companies. So very sophisticated design, partly based on Mondragon. If you know about Mondragon, some of you will know about that. We'll talk about it. Moreover, watch the sophistication. In that area, major hospitals, Cleveland Clinic, University Hospital System, Case Western Reserve, universities and hospitals, all over the country, this system, this possibility exists. They purchase $3 billion, with a B, dollars in goods and services a year. A lot of it with taxpayer money, Medicare, Medicaid, education funds. They are directing some of those purchases to this complex to stabilize and build up the community so as to really give power to this whole force. There are many others that are in the market as well. But notice the design. In a situation where the old system doesn't work, changing the ownership and in a sophisticated way, using the power of public money to expand this form, and they've used it very well. I describe it more in the book. But it is an evolution of the simple idea of how do we democratize ownership and build it in a real way. These are also extremely green developments, all of them. It's the greenest laundry in that part of the country. It's about a third of the water, a third of the heat. And it is sophisticated in its design, and 10 other cities are doing it now, and 100 cities around the country have asked about it. And you could do it here, probably will be done in California in many places, because the alternatives are not available. And there is another piece of the evolving prehistory. In Youngstown, watch the ball here closely, the international unions, the steelworkers union, was against what the local steelworkers wanted to do. They didn't want these upstarts gaining power in a new model. That would challenge the leadership. So the union leaders were against it strongly, not the local folks. There's been an evolution there, too. The United Steelworkers now are the leading proponent in the labor movement of moving in the direction of worker ownership. So you see sophistication, expanding numbers. You see institutional change, even in labor. That pattern is going on in many parts of the country. If I had time, I'd give you other illustrations, not only of numbers that you don't know about because the press doesn't cover, all characterized by decentralized ownership, but also of increasing sophistication. Two or three areas I can only touch on briefly in the time available. The healthcare system, another, we talked about municipal ownership, now we're going to the state level. The healthcare system is in severe difficulty, as you all know. It is likely to get worse before it gets better, even with Obamacare. And what is happening in some states is that the handwriting's on the wall. Vermont is the furthest along here. Connecticut is following shortly. They are moving already to some form of single payer because you can't handle the cost problems any other way. What is single payer or Medicare? It is a publicly owned insurance company. That's all it is. But you transfer the ownership to the state or the federal government. Medicare is the national public insurance company. It is a socialized insurance company, just to make it clear. And it is logically happening, and I contend will happen slowly, state by state by state. You passed it twice in California. Schwarzenegger vetoed it twice. But the pressure is to create it. This is not just stuff bubbling from the bottom. The healthcare system is a fifth of the American economy. Over time, if that moves in the patterns that I've talked about, you're talking about a big deal. And partly, as in Cleveland, it can be used to help stabilize localities. You get the picture? More about this. If you look closely, and here's another one, the banking crisis is self-evident. Virtually anyone who studies the national banking system, the experts left, right, and center predict a further crisis. And further crises, and the anger from left, right, and center against the big banks is obvious. and you can't regulate them. You can, in theory, regulate them, but in practice, they've got more power than you have. The Attorney General of the United States testified 4 weeks ago that he could not sue any of the big banks or their officers. Why? Even if criminal, let this sink in, even if criminal, to sue them would create a financial crisis, and he couldn't do it. Do you know what that means for democracy? We will have more crises. And the current nostrum, and I support it, is that we will break them up into many small banks. And then obviously they will regroup, and the big fish will eat the little fish, and we'll be back at the center. That pattern, I think, will take 20 years of evolution. But the people who understood this best, and I love this one because I have a high respect for serious conservative theorists. I don't respect political hacks. But serious conservatives who care about liberty, that they are serious people to be taken seriously. Milton Friedman's teachers, the founders of the conservative Chicago School of Economics, who cared about free market economics, knew that the big banks and the big corporations were a threat to that. And they knew you couldn't regulate them. They won Nobel Prizes for analyzing what was called regulatory capture. And they knew that if you broke them up, the little fish would eat the big fish. And we'd be back in the same place. AT&T, Standard Oil, that's the pattern. The conservative leaders of the Chicago School of Economics clarified that the only answer from a free market position was to socialize them. That was the only logical option left. Get them out. And I suspect at some point we will see more of that too down the line if you think of it as a historian and if you think about politics building over time, as in the prehistory of the Progressive Era, the prehistory of the New Deal. That direction, I think, is on the table. And by the way, those of you who don't think nationalization is possible in this conservative country, did you notice we nationalized General Motors, Chrysler, and AIG, the largest insurance company in the world, and we still own AIG. Now, when the money would start flowing, we gave it back. But the idea that this country won't deal with things like this over time in a different way is, in my view, mistaken. We're getting close to the time I'm supposed to sit down. So let me just suggest, in many parts of the system, given the crisis, we are beginning to see an evolution characterized by radical decentralization, very American, very down home. I'm from Racine, Wisconsin. I can explain it to my high school buddies. Practical, new ideas that have the characteristic of transforming the ownership of wealth, and they are expanding in numbers and sophistication because of the crisis. And they are likely to continue to expand, in my view. The next stage in all this, and I think this is where it is now, we're beginning to see a coming together also in the, quote, new economy movement, also not much covered by the press for the reasons I suggested, of ecologically sophisticated development with transformation of ownership, experimenting with different ways to do that in different parts of the country so that we get both institutional change and ecological development with it. The Cleveland model is an example of that. And we're going to see a lot more proliferation of that. Another thing we're beginning to see, and it's at a different level, is increasing sophistication about what is the nature of the systemic design that might be different from the traditional model. What does this look like if you got serious about it? If you don't like corporate capitalism, you don't like state socialism, where does this point? And a number of people who are working on this, and we've been working closely developing projects with them, academics, people like Gus Speth, some of the environmentalists know, Juliet Shore, a number of economists, the president of the American Political Science Association, the president of the Sociological Association. What is the nature of the next system to which this might point that might be democratic, ecologically sustainable, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? That's beginning to be on the table in a serious way, and in my view is going to be the next step, a big discussion. Where does it point? And finally, there is experimentation and people standing back and trying to understand themselves historically. I am talking to the person in your chair. Historically, as historical actors who might actually further this developmental trend simultaneously The Chinese have a phrase, we need to walk on two legs. We need to do whatever can be done the old ways, but we also need to develop a whole new direction in another direction and another way. I'd love to talk to you more. I'm pleased that you were here. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to sketch this much.
Thank you, Gar. I'd like to remind our audience listening at home that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today. Our program today is the emerging prehistory of the next American Revolution. Our speaker is Gar Alperovitz. I'm going to turn it over now to the audience questions.
Hello. Thank you for being here today. I'm sure you're aware that there is a press model that fits into what you are describing. The nonprofit investigative reporting organizations. Have you approached the Center for Investigative Reporting or ProPublica?
I have not approached them, but we've been in discussion with them, and you're absolutely right. There's a whole field of experimentation with a new press model.
Well, they're very powerful on the West Coast. The Center for Investigative Reporting has really taken the place of reporters, investigative reporters on newspapers, and it's headed up by Phil Bronstein, the former executive editor of the Chronicle. I really urge you to approach them and try to find some way for them to do a series on what you're talking about.
Great, thank you. Maybe we can catch up afterward.
Okay.
I'd like to get your thoughts on two disparate responses to the democratization of wealth. The first is the success that we've had in some small American cities with local currencies. And at the other extreme is the new force of global digital currencies, for example, Bitcoin. Could you assess the positives and negatives of these two approaches?
That question, to really get into it, would be a very long discussion. But let me just say, for those who don't know, that one of the areas, and I'll say this briefly, there is experimentation with alternative currencies as well, and alternative banking structures I mentioned, but also with different banking the implications of different banking structures for these currencies. I think there's a lot to be learned from both models. I'm going to stop there because it gets pretty complicated after that, as you know, but to suggest this is another element that is in the unfolding evolutionary pattern. By the way, those of you, there is the public banking conference being held in San Rafael, starts tomorrow night and Monday morning, which is looking at all the public banking part of it. Conferences are happening all over the country on each one of the elements I'm talking about. Again, there's just an explosion of information and ideas and gatherings of people. Sir.
Thanks, Gar. My question is, I was really drawn to what you brought up about exploring alternative ownership structures. You mentioned the Mondragon Cooperative, and I'm thinking here in the Bay Area especially, there's a rich history of worker collectives and cooperatives. Most of those are really small. They're niche. They're not just small physically, but the worlds and the services they provide are niche. There are some big examples like Mondragon. Avis Rent-A-Car was a worker collective at one point. REI, Sleep Train, the furniture company, is a worker collective. Some actually pretty big companies, even some multinationals in a sense. But still, those are niche companies in a sense. They are not driving the overall economy. Those are so far pretty content, and capitalism is pretty content, to let them coexist alongside of it. So I'm curious what you see as the role for those alternative ownership structures and cooperatives to not just be a niche, but to actually challenge the dominant economy and actually shape it and shift it.
Well, again, in the time available, I'm not able to do it. But I do think what's happening is the experimentation is just all over the country. But there's also a development track. That's why I wanted to just give you the Ohio track. And it's an example of how, starting with a failure and even in small scale, we're moving to larger sophistication. I think the trend is going to be moving into larger and larger areas as sophistication builds. I was in Madison, Wisconsin recently at the Isthmus Company. Some of you saw the movie on capitalism that I'm in love with capitalism. Who's the guy who ran it? You know that. Michael Moore. I'm blocking his name. It ends with this company, extremely sophisticated, high-tech company, developing tools that make modern systems of construction and manufacturing. Very, very sophisticated stuff. So we shall see, but my thought would be that we're likely to see an expansion as knowledge expands and as people understand what's going on. And it will be challenging. One of the things to note on this, by the way, so let me make this clear. I mentioned that I have a lot of respect for serious conservatives. I mean genuine conservatives. We're finding in many areas people, not this is not about the national ideologues and the radio guys, many areas what counts on the ground is practicality. And many people who are small business people or wear conservative hats maybe see this as positive, not negative. They see it as practical. And so don't write off the traditional ideological debate in the country. Look to what's practical, and you may be very surprised. We've been surprised. Sir.
Hi, my name is Peter Gisela. I'm a Vietnam-era medical veteran, and on the GI Bill, I studied existentialism and computer science system thinking, among politics and other things. At the same time, I learned that there was a bill in the Congress by a local congressman to modify the selective service system into a national youth service system. And one of his key components was to challenge youth to think about democracy for 1 year between their birthdays. And unfortunately, nobody liked this idea, both liberals and conservatives. Since 9/11, I've gotten hundreds of photographs with speakers like you and basically no response. Last year, I decided I wanted to create a website that asks, in a database sense, people like you and other academic professors and other players in our society some basic feedback regarding this idea of just challenging male-only selective service currently to think about democracy for a year and consider some kind of service, community service or military service. And if 99% of the people say no comment, is there any data there? Because that's what I've been getting now.
No, I don't think you have much data there. But I'd be happy to talk with you afterwards about what you're talking about. Thank you.
There's a movement in finance called crowdfunding, where ordinary non-accredited investors can invest online in small enterprises. How can crowdfunding, under the Jobs Act of 2012, be tweaked to support some of these structures you mentioned?
Now, that's a very good question, and indeed there's experimentation under even existing SEC law. There's some really interesting, essentially crowdfunding being developed in Washington, D.C., using the old standards, but just there are certain provisions. I don't know how you can, I do know that there are people working on how you tweak it. I also know that if I were to get into it in any depth of this audience, we'd be lost in the nitty-gritty. But I think we're going to see, it's a very tricky area. Because there are rip-offs possible in that, and it's possible to exploit crowdfunding in a very nasty way. So to get it in a way that actually worked is by no means easy. Michael Schumann, who writes about this, an author who writes about this, probably the most sophisticated person on this subject. But I'm not going to get into that thicket for the time availability question. Sir.
Just to note, you might look at cutting-edge capital locally, and also the club had a thing on sharing economy where Bob Zayek was here to talk about solar financing. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing to look at here.
Thank you for that.
I'll note that for your surprising state socialism states, you might add Texas. The Texas Land Commissioner is charged with leasing, not selling, state lands in order to raise money for the public schools. You have mentioned that credit unions,
That's very interesting. The state of Texas public school system, part of this is covered in the book, socialized land long ago in order to finance education. Yes, well, that in fact is true. They don't call it that, but that's the way it works, just as you said.
You mentioned, of course, like credit unions are organized in order to help their members with low-cost capital. And if you go to one of the meetings to elect the directors, you don't see anyone there.
Right.
You say the same thing with savings and loans. I've been to those meetings when they existed. But that's the nub here, then, is in looking at the worker-owned units or the credit unions that are successful, what has been the key to getting involvement and oversight? Because that's what I see as being the real problem here. We have these great models. We've got this Class B corporation now. We've got the credit unions. But we don't see people sticking with it to make it happen.
It's a very good question. And I've been following this work and involved in it for 30 years. What is really interesting about this moment and about the new economy movement is it is beginning, think of this as a historian would, we are beginning to see them, people identifying themselves as part of a movement. That's different from doing experiments. When people begin to see themselves and self-identify, all of us in a different way, then they begin to open up a different vision, possibly. And the new economy movement in the last 3 or 4 years has begun to do that, begun to create a sense of This is not just experiments that are interesting. It changes the motivation. It changes the vision. It changes the stick-to-itiveness. It changes the commitment. When people self-identify as historical actors, let me say that again. When you understand yourself as part of history rather than a participant, an audience, someone who does projects, someone who likes politics, things change. That's a big deal in history at the level of idea systems. So these, I've been talking about practical things. But when you see a movement beginning to think of itself as a movement, something else happened. That doesn't guarantee success. But one way to think about that is this. My heroes in all this are the civil rights workers in Mississippi in the 1930s. They knew that you had to build a movement step by step, laying groundwork, even in very difficult situations, until the fire exploded. We are in a period not nearly as dangerous as it was in Mississippi, but there is something brewing that is very important, and it revolves around these themes that we're talking about.
Yes, thank you for presenting such a beautiful utopian view of the future. However, it's all dependent upon redistribution of capital. And I dare you to give us one historic, significant precedence where that has happened without violence.
Let me think. So it is possible that there will be violence at some point. I'm not predicting that. But it is also possible that there will be evolutionary change. That question does not speak to the problem. That is to say, it may or may not be that there will be violence, historically. In the last part of the book, I lay out several options, one of which is repression and violence. And then I point out that if you look to Latin America, repression and violence in many parts of Latin America was not the end of the story. Those dictators are gone. So if you see yourself historically, and maybe possibly as activist as those poor little colonial folks on the eastern seaboard in the late part of the 18th century, farmers and small merchants who took on the largest empire in the history of the world at that point and defeated the British Empire, but had there's a French word, chutzpah, to challenge the empire, your question becomes secondary. There is great violence now going on with people being essentially imprisoned, being denied health care, being done in subtle ways. I am not predicting violence. I think we don't know what will happen. It could get a lot worse, quite apart from everything I've said. We could easily see that the dangerous trends explode and produce real violence and suppression. But to ask the question in the appropriate way, I think, is to say, is there a possibility for forward development that begins to move and lay the basis for a system that makes sense, building on American traditions? The options are no, this is all secondary and marginal. We'll see. Another option is this might bolster the old liberal model, replacing the union, helping keep things in line. It might lead to violence and suppression and repression. Period. The corporate state might take over forever. Maybe. Another option is the Latin American option, that beyond that, the problem still is with you. What do you want? What does the system look like? And just possibly, as in the feminist revolution, the civil rights revolution, the early part of the environmental revolution, the late 19th century prehistory of populism, the prehistory of the progressive era, the American Revolution, and countless other transformations from the collapse of apartheid to the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, it is also possible that this particular society will transform itself historically. This is only 2013.
Do you think there is something inherent in the organization of the worker co-ops you mentioned that prevent the consolidation dynamic of big fish eats little fish? Or might they result in mega, unmanageable, unregulatable, near megacorps in the long-term future? Is this aggregation of power and wealth and then break up an inherent dynamic cyclically?
We don't know the answer to that. But we do know from the Mondragon experience, which is 85,000-person complex integrated co-op in the Basque Country of Spain, most probably most folks here know about it, which is very sophisticated in many, many industries. They've been able to evolve a very interesting participatory structure, competing successfully in the European and the global market in many, many fields, with ratios of highly participatory, with ratios of income in most parts from top to bottom 6 to 1. American corporations are 300 to 1 commonly. And in a couple of the bigger ones, it's not as good, 8 to 1. So we know that it can be done from the Mondragon experience. And it's very hot, but by the way, in the new economy movement, Mondragon's a very hot topic because it gets you to systemic design at least one step beyond just experiments. But your question is certainly the right question. How do we do that in a complex way, in a complex society, in a complex economy?
I have one example of an emerging co-op possibility I'd like you to comment on, and a resource for co-op emergence that I'd like your thoughts on. The emerging possibility is I'm working with folks in the Midwest who are trying to assemble a cooperative around the Midwestern tradition for procuring streetcar equipment and general contracting capabilities so that the second-tier cities throughout the Midwest that long for the restoration of streetcars as a public investment could do so in a cooperative fashion and share the risk and expertise that would allow them to overcome some of the initial cost. And the source of resource that would be interesting to hear you comment on is the University of Wisconsin's Center on Cooperatives that has an elaborate website about how to start, own, operate, and maintain cooperatives that I thought was in that tradition, ready to go for today's emergence. So.
It is, first, I think it's a really interesting idea, and I've talked to several people who are trying to do that. The return to this, we don't build any, we build very little streetcars here. There is a small company in Oregon that does it, but there's several cities that are looking at this as a new market. And another, but as I say, almost everywhere one hears about a new experiment that people are trying, and there is university expertise available. When the Youngstown, this is an important part of the historical concept. When Youngstown was developed in 1977, there were very few people you could call on who knew anything about worker ownership. There were steel experts. You want to set up a worker-owned company now, there's expertise all over the country, just as you said. And that also is a historic development to look at as part of what we're talking about. Sir.
Garth, thank you for the invitation to think of ourselves as historical actors in a culture that encourages anything but that. A couple of questions that weave together. Why aren't there more Mondragons? That's the example that always gets pointed to. Why aren't there more like that? Why, despite all the growth of worker co-ops in the country, why aren't there more? Or more practically to ask that question, what are the real barriers? What are the challenges and hurdles to either creating new enterprises that are worker-owned or converting existing enterprises to worker ownership? What's in the way?
Well, the one of the things that's in the way is knowledge, that people don't really know you can do it. Mm-hmm. People don't realize you can. If you are an owner about to sell your business, and as I say, there are millions in this baby boom retirement age, you can do very well in the tax system if you sell to workers. And that's just knowledge. Mm-hmm. Nobody's been promoting the idea. So that's the biggest thing that I see in the way. The other thing is that people, it's hard to do. It's not a simple thing to do. What I think is dealing with that is the necessity to do something. Their options are diminishing, so I think there's a pressure for that as well. I think that's what part of this movement building is all about, where the light bulb goes on. We could do it. If you can do it in Cleveland, we could do it here. That's the sort of thing that's happening. But nonetheless, it is not a simple developmental task. You have to assemble expertise. You have to assemble a political coalition or at least alliance. You have to bring together the institutional partners. It's a lot of work. But as I say, what's forcing it is that the alternatives are narrowing in many parts of the country.
Thank you.
Hi, I would appreciate your response to what I see are two countervailing forces on this civic engagement. One is the erosion of the federal civil service. I mean, when you're seeing all the institutional cuts, and for example, NSF is now calling for things like not funding the American Political Science Association, that's very dangerous. And the other trend we see in the United States is that we are not communities, we are individuals. You talk about the corporations, we talk about communities, but there are so many individuals, and we have new immigrants who don't necessarily come from a democratic, tradition. So
two things in response to that. Just to return to the larger historical framing, it is precisely because of the decay of the current system, as you speak, that precisely because of the failure and decay of the old system that people are being forced to do the new things. So I assume that in the analysis, that we will see worsening of the conditions at the national level. I'm not sure about the different cultures that are coming in. That is to say, there is in the Hispanic culture a communitarian vision as well. And in some other groups that are coming together around community visions and community cooperation, that's a very mixed story, and there are lots of opportunities there. And there are also lots of opportunities in Catholic theology, and particularly with the new Pope. That is, Catholic economic and social theology, leaving aside some of the other questions, is very positive on these subjects and very challenging. And in some of the communities, particularly Hispanic, the Catholic issue is very important.
Hey, I just want to say, my name is John. I work at a nonprofit in Richmond, California, and we actually are trying to replicate the Cleveland model there. We're incubating a solar installation worker-owned co-op. And so you can check out our website, Solar Richmond. The name of the business is Pomoja Energy Solutions, if any of you want solar on your house or business that, building that you own. So just want to say that first. But two, about two questions ago, the guy said that, or you gave the answer that there's a lack of knowledge about co-ops, and I definitely find that's true in the work that I do. And how do you think, if so many people are part of it, like, why is there a lack of discussion about it at a national level? Or, like, why is it not catching ground if there's a lot of people involved and a lot of interest in it?
In fact, it is catching ground. That's what's interesting, because it has been quietly evolving at the grassroots level. Now it's moving to national, the changes in the National Cooperative Business Association, which has been a very conservative part of the co-op movement. It's beginning to foster worker-owned companies. So there is this evolving knowledge involving change in ideas as well as change in the ground. We'll see how far it goes. It has to be developed. But that's the news. That's the news that there is a movement of building rather than all the isolated. It is not a movement that's achieved movement scale, but it is building up in many, many areas. This is one of them.
Thank you.
Thanks. I'm afraid we've reached the point in our program now. I don't know if I'm on or not, but we've reached a point in our program now where we have only time for one or two quick questions. So I'm going to extend just a minute because the last questioner is someone I would like to hear from. But so we have time for two quick questions, and then we'll be closing. I'd like to let our audience listening at home know today this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program is The Emerging Prehistory of the Next American Revolution with Gar Alperovitz.
I'd like to know, you mentioned the national steel workers came along years later after the local, and I was wondering if you could mention a couple factors involved in that shift.
Well, the first part of it was that the earlier tradition was a very hidebound, tough union organizing vision and very centralized leadership that had very little vision. The steel industry has been in trouble, and it's gotten worse and worse. And there's been a more sophisticated leadership move. So I think it's a combination of the larger conditions I've been trying to sketch here. Historical conditions are worsening, forcing people into new areas, and partly leadership and partly knowledge. Mondragon has been very important in all this because it's a very sophisticated operation in many different areas, and people realize you can do things like that in many parts of the world. You could probably do it here. So that I think that's what's happening. And some of the other unions are now looking over their shoulders at what the steelworkers are doing. They're in trouble looking for a new model as well.
Thank you.
We very much appreciate this message, particularly here in San Francisco, where we have the first privatized national park, where we have a private power company in violation of federal law, and we have a private garbage collection system. We really appreciate this. But my question goes to your background in Wisconsin, your work for Governor Nelson and your experience in Wisconsin. What in the hell happened in Wisconsin? And how do we explain that, and what do we do about it?
You know, it's a us Wisconsin Badgers. That's the state. So I can't answer your question in detail, but I can give you a way to think about it, maybe. Look, you and I are from that era. Yeah. I was brought up in Wisconsin during the McCarthy era. Now, Joe McCarthy nationally shot anything that moved. In Wisconsin, it was triple bad. People were scared out of their mind to do anything. And it's the late 1950s. And if you read the tea leaves of the time in Wisconsin in the late 1950s, you knew political economic change was not possible. McCarthy shot anything that moved. So you were clear about the future. And then the 60s exploded. The lesson there is who knows what will happen, but it is a mistake to read the conservative moment as the end of history. Just possibly, I'm not saying inevitably, just possibly something's happening down there below the surface that you aren't getting in the newspapers and may be exploding. In Wisconsin as well. I've been out there recently, and there's another piece of this developing that may or may not, you know, Ryan got almost defeated. Ryan is from Racine, Wisconsin District, my hometown, and was almost defeated in the last election. We shall see.
Milwaukee Journal did not get shot by McCarthy, but they sure as hell changed the last few
years. That's right. Thank you for that question.
All right, well, thank you, everyone. And I would like to thank our speaker today, Gar Alperovitz. I'd like to thank our audience here and our people listening at home. With that, I will conclude today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion. This session is adjourned.